Okay. Perhaps we should get started. I'm very pleased indeed and honoured to welcome Professor Frank Clooney to give the Majewski lecture this term. Frank was here some years ago as the academic director of the centre, about 3 years ago, two, three years ago, and he's now the Parkman Professor of Divinity and Comparative Theology at Harvard. He needs hardly any introduction. He's written many books on comparative theology and indeed on South Asian Sri Vaishnavism. His initial work was on the Mimamsa tradition with his book Thinking Ritually, and he's written many books since then, Seeing Through Texts. His last book was Hindu God, Christian God, and he's working on a number of projects at the moment that I'm sure he'll be telling you about. And today he's going to speak to us on Vedanta Deshika's defence of Sri and the Srimad Rahasya Trayasara 23 and its theological implications. So I'll hand it over to you, Frank. Thank you.
Well, I would just begin by echoing what Professor Flood had to say about it's a nice opportunity to be here and to be back in this context. I think it was about 4 years ago this time that I introduced Professor Flood for one of these lectures, so it's like karma catches up with you after some time. But I was very happy in my day here to have the opportunity to bring in speakers for the Majewski lecture, and I think I've never met Mr. Majewski, but we're all grateful to him for making these lectures possible and to have speakers come in. So I'm grateful for being here and very nice for all of you to be here with us today. What I would hope to be able to do in the course of this lecture would be to present the ideas that I have and reflections on Sri in the Srimad Rahasya Trayasara, particularly in the one chapter 23, more or less following the two handouts that you have available to you. And then leave a good bit of time at the end so that we could have some interaction and your comments or questions related to what I have to say. Because I think in some ways it's a necessary feature of this kind of academic work is on the one hand to uncover the details and uncover the meaning of the text according to simply what it says in its context. But then there's always the further level of reflection asking what does this mean for readers today, and then who are the readers today and how does it engage different readers. So I think hopefully when I have presented the material, we will have a number of things to talk about that we can share together your comments on what I have to say. In the simplest terms, what I'm doing when it says Rahasya Trayasara 23, Rahasya Trayasara written by Vedanta Deshika, I think most of you know about this text and I needn't go into too much detail. A great Sri Vaishnava South Indian text, Tamil Sanskrit language tradition from the 14th century in South India. One of the great classic works of Indian thought, I think, by tradition written by Vedanta Deshika, one of the truly great scholars of India in any language, in any tradition. By tradition written by him at the end of his life. He lived approximately to 100 years old and supposedly was way up in his 90s when he finished this work. And while that is hard to show, there's no reason to deny it, but it's hard to pin that down, it does seem to be the kind of fulsome, complete, reflective work that one would expect from a very senior scholar. So I think that is important to keep in mind that this man who wrote so much in Tamil and in Sanskrit and in the Manipravala mix of both, by tradition put together this reflection on the three mantras, the Rahasya Trayasara late in his life as kind of a final reflection. Within that work, a work of 32 chapters, four chapters, chapters 23, 24, 25, and 26, are dedicated to rebutting and clarifying issues that others seem to have objected to, issues related to the nature of moksha, the nature of surrender or prapatti, the nature of God, the nature of the self, the implications of prapatti or radical surrender for the caste system, varna and ashrama, and related issues. And it seems that this section of the text, chapters 23, 24, 25, 26, are, I always think, and I could not prove this, kind of a second edition of the text, that the original edition, in a sense, gave you the exposition, the exegesis, and the narrative of radical surrender and its implications, almost as if these chapters come after receiving the reactions of his critics and clarifying points that needed to be clarified in defending issues. The text I'll be focusing on is the very end of chapter 23, a chapter in which he has been explaining the nature of the Siddhopaya, the Lord as the kind of accomplished, complete means of salvation, the kind of objective nature of salvation as the Lord does this and not the individual devotee. At the end of the chapter, he has a heated section, very passionate, intense section, arguing why the goddess Sri Lakshmi is in every way equal to her consort Vishnu or Narayana. And what I would like to do in the first part of my lecture is put that in context of other things that might be said about Sri, including by Vedanta Deshika, and then focus on that particular section, teasing out something of his central argument in that section, and then something about his conception of reasoning in that section, and then his appeal to tradition. All of that became in that one very intense part of his text. Basically, because I think we see in that context where he seems very much to care passionately about what he's saying, we see revealed in very kind of vulnerable, clear form the nature of his thinking and the nature of a theologian when the theologian is at his or her best. And I think that really raises issues, therefore, not only about Sri as a goddess or Sri in relationship to Vishnu, but also about how the theological mind works in Brahmanical India in the 14th century, but also, I think, by extension in a comparative context. The first part of what I'd say, and I'll be more or less following the handout that has the outline. I won't refer to it much, but you can sort of follow down the page as I go along. I'd like to make several points first about how chapter 23 and the discussion of Sri in chapter 23 is not unique. It's not self-standing as some extraordinary defense of Sri in relation to Vishnu, but comes in a very rich and large context. And the first element would be that by no means could anyone imagine that Vedanta Deshika is inventing a position for Sri and Sri Vaishnavism. There's a long tradition before Vedanta Deshika of her importance, of her major role in the tradition. If we go into the prehistory of Sri Vaishnavism, we might even say that most scholars agree that Sri has an independent role, a distinct role in Indian culture, in religion in India, even apart from Vaishnavism. And that is something I'm less familiar with and have not done my own research on. But Sri as an independent goddess with her own cult, somewhere in the first millennium, coming into play in the context of the cult of Vishnu Narayana. And therefore, an issue for Sri Vaishnava theologians, either in the earlier devotional period of the Alvars, the Tamil saints, or in the more systematic period of the theologians like Ramanuja up to Vedanta Deshika, having to explain her position in relationship to Vishnu Narayana, not simply as a topic for discussion, but to continue to integrate the cult of Sri into the cult of Vishnu and Vaishnavism. Texts about Sri go way back, and I think I will not try to explain all that or point that all out in this context, but I do point out that in the tradition that the Sri Vaishnavas see as their own, if one goes back to the Tamil poetry of the late first millennium, there are innumerable references to the goddess Sri or Sri Lakshmi in the Tamil poetry. And this shows that at least by the 6th or 7th century, people were connecting the cult of Sri with the cult of Vishnu, largely in a non-problematic way, that devotion to one is devotion to the other. And that it was more or less taken for granted, but in some way taken as part of the larger vision of who Vishnu is and who Sri is, that they would be taken as part of a single act of devotion. And this is common enough in the Alvars poetry that it seems to, you have to assume, been more pervasive in the culture as well as in the particular texts that we have. There are also Sanskrit texts that one might point to, Pancharatra text, Puranic texts, texts like the Lakshmi Tantra, a text, as it indicates by its title, that spells out many different angles about mantra, the practice of religion, the practice of meditation in India, with a focus on the teachings of Lakshmi and the role of Lakshmi in the tradition. This text is quoted frequently by Vedanta Deshika and is in the background kind of putting forward the fact that of course she is important and of course she has a major role in our tradition. It also goes without saying, though I'll say it, that in texts like the Ramayana, the role of Sita in relation to Rama, the Sri Vaishnavas take for granted that this reference to Sita and Rama is a reference to the divine couple of Sri and Vishnu. And so there's much of that kind of context even before one gets to the Sri Vaishnava theologians. In the Sri Vaishnava tradition itself, before the time of Ramanuja in the 11th century approximately, his predecessor Yamana, or Alavandar in Tamil, wrote a text called the Chatushloki, the four shlokas, four verses praising the goddess Lakshmi and or Sri and her place in the tradition. Vedanta Deshika in his day and age writes a commentary, an extensive commentary on those four verses, appealing to the fact and acknowledging the fact that long before his time, Sri was given an important place. Ramanuja, in his standard works, the Sri Bhashya commentary, in his Vedarta Sangraha, his Gita commentary, makes very little of Sri, and Sri is not a prominent figure in those works. If, as the Sri Vaishnava tradition does make very clear, works like the three Gadyas, or kind of prose poems of praise attributed to Ramanuja, particularly the Sharanagati Gadyam, the Gadya of absolute surrender, in that work, which is attributed to Shankara, and I think we might as well assume it is by Shankara, Ramanuja, Sri has an extraordinarily important role. And that one cannot go and take refuge at the feet of Narayana before taking refuge at the feet of Sri first. And again, this is before the time of Deshika, so he does not need to make this point. After Ramanuja, there's the Sri Stava, Vatsanka Mishra, the Sri Gunaratna Kosha, Parashara Bhattar, and a number of other such texts in which Vaishnavas are increasingly of the view that any reflection on Vishnu or Narayana is always going to be a reflection on Sri Lakshmi at the same time. And all of this is in place. So when I talk today about the contribution or the particular addition that Vedanta Deshika is making to the cult of Sri Lakshmi in Vaishnavism, by no means am I implying that he's doing something entirely new. There's a long tradition before him. He's taking this for granted. He's affirming it. He's part of it. And I think perhaps the best way to think about what he is doing is trying to strengthen the theological basis for this tradition so as to ensure that the cult, the piety, the devotion are able to continue on a level that is rational as well as emotional. And that he's really spelling out the implications that need to be spelled out systematically so that the cult of the tradition can continue properly. I can make some comparative issues on that, but I'll come back to that later. In Vedanta Deshika's own works, I think it would also, another kind of clarification of what is not new about the chapter that I'm focusing on, this is by no means the only place that Vedanta Deshika talks about the goddess Sri Lakshmi in Rahasya Trayasara, chapter 23. I already mentioned that he wrote a full commentary on the Chatushloki of Alavandar or Yamana, a very technical work expounding the meaning of the four verses of Yamana, and basically trying to defend from a number of angles the importance of Sri and her place in the Sri Vaishnava theological tradition. So that already he's done in other works, and particularly if we take the Srimad Rahasya Trayasara as late in his life, then I think we have to be aware that he's already talked about this. Another of his great works, which I believe I mentioned on the handout, the Nyaya Siddhanjana, one of his great works in his kind of Vaishnava version of the Nyaya tradition, in the chapter on the Lord, the Ishwara Paricheda, he gives an exposition and defense of the nature of Narayana, the nature of Narayana in relation to other deities such as Shiva and Brahma, and then dedicates the last part of the chapter to an exposition of the relationship of Sri and Vishnu. And typical of his work, and he does this a number of times in Rahasya Trayasaram, he'll go through a teaching on Vishnu Narayana as if this is sort of a given theological topic, and then insist on adding a teaching on Sri at the end of the chapter. It's not always at the end of the chapter, but it usually is. As if in some point in the tradition, there was felt a need that also we need to talk about Sri, and that it's often placed at the end, almost as if it's a second level of redaction or something like that. But in the Nyaya Sudanjana, having argued about the proper way of thinking about God, the way of thinking about the Lord, and thinking about Narayana as that Lord, he then goes on to explain that one cannot properly understand the Lord without understanding the goddess Sri, and understanding her properly in no way is detrimental to our understanding of who Narayana is, and that all of this is a continuity. And he says in the Nyaya Sudanjana, as he says in Rahasya Trayasara, that the distinctive teaching of our tradition is not simply a teaching about Vishnu Narayana, but it's a teaching about Vishnu Narayana with Sri, and that one does not get the specificity of the tradition without understanding her role as well. So these are places, you know, outside the Rahasya Trayasara, where he's already defended at some length her position and her place. In the Rahasya Trayasara itself, there are a number of chapters in which he discusses her place. The first part of the text, up to chapter 19 or so, is more like a narrative, a prose narrative, expounding the tattva hitta purusharta, the reality or the metaphysical principles of the tradition, the path of surrender, and then the implications of that in terms of the goal of life, the goal of the ethical life. In a number of these chapters, he talks about the role of Sri. For instance, in chapters 4 and 5, when he's describing the Tattva Traya and the Artha Panchaka, the three essential principles or three realities of our tradition, and then the five things to be known by anyone seeking moksha or liberation. In those chapters, he has care to talk about Sri as well as Vishnu Narayana. And I think he's trying to make the point that while one could talk about the Lord, conscious beings and non-conscious beings, or about the path to liberation without mentioning her, he insists on bringing her into that kind of exposition. In chapter 11 of the Rahasya Trayasara, when talking about the nature of Prapatti, he seems to go out of his way to raise the psychological problem: is it really useful or possible to imagine taking refuge at the feet of the Lord? Why would we think that this would actually be effective in changing our situation when karma is so burdensome, when life is so short, when prapatti is rarely performed perfectly, when the Lord is so transcendent, so as to be beyond any kind of being swayed by things that human beings do? He deliberately at that point brings in the role of Sri as the mediator, the Purushakara, and says, we can have confidence that Prapatti works, and confidence to go ahead and perform this act because she is there. More or less saying that for this, you know, not simply in theory, but in practice, for this to work out, one has to be able to see that she has a role, not simply theologically or ontologically, but a role in psychologically persuading people that this makes sense and that this can be done. And the way that's interesting is that it's not so much at the level of I will now say something about Sri, but at the level of trying to argue about the value of Prapatti, saying we in our tradition don't believe that Prapatti or surrender can work unless we realize that she is there. And so she has this integral role. It's interesting, though, that in chapter 3 and chapter 12 of Rahasya Trayasara, chapter 3 is the distinctive teaching of our tradition, and basically about the famous soul-body relationship, that just as the body cannot survive or exist without having an Atman or a soul within to keep it from disintegrating or keep it in existence, so too the universe cannot exist outside of total dependence on God. And that's like a soul-body relationship, that all things that exist, conscious or non-conscious, are dependent on the Lord. In that entire chapter, he never mentioned Sri once. And this would in some ways make me think that there are parts of this text and part of the tradition he's tapping into where it was not deemed mentioned to talk about her at all. That when you're talking about the ontology of Vaishnavism, it may not have been necessary to mention her. But more oddly, in chapter 12, which is really about the act of prapatti, the act of actual surrender, the components of it, the prayer of surrender and so on, with the so-called Dwaya mantra of actual surrender, she's not mentioned in that chapter either. Implicitly, because the Dwaya mantra is Sri Man Narayana, Narayana with Sri, you might say, well, of course she's implicit there. But in talking about the act of taking refuge at the feet of the Lord, for some reason her name doesn't come up in that chapter. And that, again, is a little odd, but it's something to think about, that this has not been entirely systematized at this point. I would only, one other thing before pointing to two major chapters. At the end, the beginning and end of every chapter in Rahasya Trayasara, there are verses. At the beginning of every chapter, a verse in Sanskrit. At the end of every chapter, a verse in Sanskrit and a verse in Tamil. And often in passing, as if it's simply to be taken for granted, mentioning Vishnu Narayana is also mention of Sri Lakshmi as well. I'll just give you one example of that. From chapter 6, he says this, and this is not the most elegant translation, but it does get the point across, I think. Lest disputants by their arrogant logic disturb the secret Veda, lest good people be thoroughly upset when some people go about teaching one or another God as the first one. So against this kind of tendency to confuse the people with novel teachings, our great teachers, our forest teachers, affirm our ancient Lord, who abides with his lovely Shri, who abides in the lotus. And in a different context, we could talk about what does that add. So, of course, they affirm the Lord, they affirm going to the Lord in refuge. Why is it important to say, who abides with his lovely Shri, who abides in the lotus? It seems part of his visual and imaginative representation of the true teaching, that of course she is present. In another verse, he gives kind of a description of what Narayana is like. By direct perception and from within himself, the Lord ever knows all things. He is a boundless ocean of divine mercy for whom nothing is impossible. The daughter of the ocean is half of him. He is the God who protects the world. He is the highest person. He is the way that is already accomplished. He has accepted the burden of the good. And much of that could just be said as it is about Narayana, but right in the middle of it, without comment, the daughter of the ocean is half of him. And I think, again, it's an iconic representation of the two of them together, but it's in the piety and the poetry of the tradition that Deshika is deliberately writing his own verses, showing that, of course, she is part of this, and whatever is said about him is in some way said about her. So all of that is in the context of the whole text. It still seems to me that, if any of you have looked at this text ever, that there's much in it that could lead you to kind of a notion that in earlier redactions of the text or in earlier versions of the material in the text, one could imagine it being primarily about Vishnu Narayana. And then in kind of another layer of reflection begins to tease out her importance and bring it to the fore. Because some places where you expect her to appear, she doesn't. Some places where she's not present, it seems like an odd omission. Some places it doesn't seem there's anything missing at all by leaving her out. So there's a kind of a uneven presentation of her in this text in general. But the two places where she is most important, one I'll mention briefly, and then the one is the chapter 23. Chapter 28 is the long exegesis of the so-called Dwaya mantra. As I give you there, Sriman Narayana Charanam Sharanam Prapadye Srimate Narayanaya Namaha. I take refuge at the feet of Narayana with Sri, obeisance or praise to Narayana with Sri. And as an exegete, he is deliberately, kind of relentlessly going through each syllable of each of those words in order to explain the mantra. And therefore, really in an expected fashion, takes very seriously the meaning of Sri and the meaning of the man, or with Sri, or the mat. And what does this mean? He takes this on very clearly, as some of you will know from other texts. There are traditionally six meanings given to the word Shri here. Shriyate, she is taken refuge with. Shriyate, she herself takes refuge. Shrinoti, she hears. Shravayati, she makes heard. Shrinati, she removes your karma. And Shrinati, she makes ripen your karma, or makes you ready for prapatti. So as other texts have done before him, the meanings of the word Shri itself, he plays out in chapter 28 in some detail, and goes on to talk with many scriptural quotations about each of those six meanings, about why Shri is here. And then the meaning of the with, or the mut. And this is a problem even in chapter 28. It's more of a problem in chapter 23. When you say Narayana with Shri, what kind of a relationship do they have with the with? And it gets into some technical Sanskrit discussion about whether the mut, the with, is to be used in relationship between beings that are inseparable from one another. Because it seems to establish a relationship between two beings that could be thought of separately. So Narayana, and in this particular instance, Narayana, who happens now to be with Sri. And the opponent, even in chapter 28, is saying, well, because it's of this form, it's like saying the man who has the book in his hand, or the lady with the flower. You could talk about the man or the woman without the book, without the flower. And therefore, Sri Man Narayana, Sri Mate Narayanaya indicates that they can be thought of separately and are thought of together in this context. Just to put it briefly, that in this context, Vedanta Deshika says, well, sure, that's the normal grammatical implication of the with in this context, but in this case it doesn't mean that. In this case it points to their invariable relationship to one another. And that in itself is something to talk about. Certainly I think we can, on the one hand, see that arguments and appeals to grammar are important, and certainly in the Indian context are extremely important, but maybe not invariable. But you do wonder when an author comes along and says, well, of course it usually means that, but in this case it doesn't. In some ways that could be perfectly intelligible and perfectly plausible. But in other ways it might be, well, isn't that convenient that you found an exception when you want one? And that's the kind of thing he worries about in this relationship, that I think implication, really not maybe in his Vaishnava tradition, although we'll see in chapter 23 that it's more of an issue, isn't it sufficient to take refuge at the feet of Narayana? Stop. She may have some role in relationship to this, but that's quite sufficient. What is the point of saying with Sri? Couldn't it be done simply in a kind of almost a purer, simpler monotheistic fashion? You go to Narayana. He admits in chapter 28, more or less without discussion, that she can be thought of as the Purushakara, or the mediator, and that in order to come to him, one comes to her first, as Ramanuja did in his Gadya. One comes to her, and then that enables one to go to him. This seems to be, in fact, the older synthesis before the time of Vedanta Deshika, perhaps even in some of his earlier works, that of course she is indispensable because she is the mediator of reaching the Lord, who is the dispenser of salvation. Reaching him is the liberating moment, and she is the one who makes that possible. And in chapter 28, where the mantra is being explained, he doesn't argue about this very much. He simply sort of takes for granted that kind of synthesis. She is important. She is related to refuge. She is to be thought of with the Lord. You can't really separate them out and just talk about him. And we talk about this as the role of the mediator, the Purushakara. And it's almost as if, again, I'm psychologizing it because I have no evidence about the redaction of this text to say to, that synthesis kind of stood, and almost as if somebody reading an earlier version of Rahasya Trayasara would come up and say, well, this means that because he is the means of salvation, the upaya, and she is the Purushakara, he is first and she is second. And that in a sense, although she is the one who makes it happen and makes it easier, at least in theory, it could happen without her at all. And therefore, let us assume that while she in fact is there and in fact is useful and in fact brings this about, it need not be the case. All of that is prefatory to saying something about chapter 23. I won't be able to, in our short time, to go through the other handout in detail, but I give you kind of a full analysis there of the argumentation in chapter 23, and I will now say something to you about it, and then reflect on it more in a comparative context. But it seems in chapter 23, where a number of problems are taken up about the nature of the Lord, the nature of going and taking refuge with the Lord, what kind of relationship one has to Narayana in the act of prapatti. The fifth and final objection that's taken up in the chapter is about what is exactly the role of Sri in relationship to surrender and into the act of liberation. What is interesting about this section in chapter 23, first of all, is that the notion of Purushakara, a mediator, never comes up. And it seems that maybe, let's take that for granted, and let's take for granted that's the teaching of our tradition, that she is the mediator, so therefore let's not talk about that anymore. It seems at some level to imply that he is dissatisfied now with that language, which he just uses without comment in chapter 28. So you have to sort of, I'm assuming a kind of chronology, which maybe I cannot defend, but that in 23, he's beginning to think that the language of mediator is no longer adequate. And therefore in chapter 23 begins to seek another language in which to talk about this. The other preparatory comment I would make is that when you read chapters, when you read the whole Rahasya Trayasara, and then particularly 23 to 26, it's definitely a debate in the innermost circle of this tradition. Most of the Rahasya Trayasara is not thinking of arguing with Buddhists or arguing with Shaivites and other groups and in the Advaitins and so on. It seems particularly 23 through 26 is kind of he's in fact or through his teaching, arguing with the leading acharyas of the tradition, that this is kind of an inner circle arguing about the details of the tradition, and that it's a really, therefore, much more is taken for granted, but it's also in some ways extremely intense because the most learned representatives of the tradition are disagreeing about something of great importance, whether Sri has a role in the act of liberation or is only a mediator of the liberation that is given only by Narayana himself. And so I think it's a key internal and central point that is being argued among kind of the elite central group of the tradition. I won't again go into the details too much, but the argument is based on the distinction between two terms that I give there on the first handout, Upalakshana and Visheshana. And it seems that this language, in a sense, comes not quite from nowhere, but has not been prominent in the Rahasya Trayasaram up to this point. The words do not appear together, as far as I can tell, anywhere else in the Rahasya Trayasaram, even in chapter 28 when Sri is talked about. So there's a kind of technical pairing of these two terms here that you do not see elsewhere. And in brief, Upalakshana and Visheshana and other experts in the room can explain this better than me, perhaps, are two kinds of ways in which attributes or qualities or characteristics can be understood to be in relationship to that which they indicate or define. And the way they're being used in this context is that an upalakshana is a temporary designation. So the tree over there with the bird on it. It's a perfectly adequate way of indicating that tree as opposed to the other tree next to it, but there's no suggestion here that tree always has that bird sitting on it. If you came tomorrow, you wouldn't be able to make that upalakshana because the bird will have flown somewhere else. But at the moment, it's perfectly adequate, or the tree there with the full moon above it. Well, if you come at noontime the next day, the full moon will not be visible, so you can't make that representation. But in the short run, it actually works. And then the other kind of designation, visheshana, refers to some kind of an innate, permanent specification. In the example I give there, the omniscient and merciful God. That, and this could be just as well in the Christian tradition, I suppose, that God, by our definition, is the one who is omniscient and merciful. If this being were not merciful, it would not be God. If it was not omniscient, it would not be God. And therefore, this is not a characteristic that some days Narayana is omniscient or some days he's merciful and other days he's not, but this is a constant characteristic. Or in Advaita terms, Sat-Chit-Ananda, pure being, consciousness, bliss. These are permanent attributes of the divine person. There is a kind of history to this term which I found where the terms are used together, and this is just a footnote, it's a bit too technical maybe to go into, is back in Ramanuja's commentary on the Uttara Mimamsa Sutras, the Sri Bhashya. So in that context, on the second sutra, when the relationship between Brahman as ultimate reality is being explained in relationship to the world, there's a long debate in Ramanuja, and which does not really appear in these terms in Shankara's commentary, about whether the world relates to Brahman as a means of knowing Brahman by upalakshana or visheshana. And one idea would be, well, in fact, given the circumstances in which we exist, thinking about the finiteness of the world, the inexplicability of the world at its own terms, it in fact is a reminder that there must be some maker of the world. but that could be taken as more or less the bird on the tree kind of analogy. In fact, this is the way we think about that which is beyond, but just as the tree has no relationship to the full moon that's above it, and the full moon is not affected by this tree, presumably, likewise, Brahman is really not really defined by this world, and if this world did not exist, it would have no effect on the nature of the Supreme Reality. The other view, which Ramanuja also presents, is that the world in some ways marks a quality that we see in old Upanishads, like the Taittiriya Upanishad, that from which the world comes forth, by which it is preserved, in which it exists until its dissolution, that is its source, the pure being from which all things come forth. And to imagine one without the other is really inexplicable. So part of the nature of the ultimate reality is that this bountiful creation or emanation of the world is a defining feature of the nature of the ultimate reality as we know it. And in his technical discussion, which I'll stop and won't go any much further into, Ramanuja basically says that by upalakshana or visheshana, we can talk about Brahman and know something about Brahman even before we get to Shruti or the Upanishads. And so there's a way in which there is a certain kind of analogical knowledge of the divine reality that is known by knowing something about the world. And you can see parallels in Western theology to this point. Without mentioning that, it seems easiest to say Vedanta Deshika is taking that same terminology of upalakshana visheshana from Ramanuja and now applying it to Sri in relationship to Narayana. There may be some intervening source. I just haven't found yet any text that takes both upalakshana and visheshana and talks about them together. One of his predecessors, Pariyavachan Pillai, in one of his texts, the Paranta Rahasya, talks about visheshana, but does not talk about upalakshana in the same text. And it seems Vedanta Deshika, I have not found earlier thinkers than Vedanta Deshika who use both terms together, so that's a good clue. But the argument, and again, it's on the other sheet, which I won't go through, and we can look at the details in our discussion if you wish. But basically, the opposing view, which again, it's not ever clear who exactly the opposing view is held by, whether these are simply adversaries that he's created for the sake of argument, or other acharyas that remain unnamed whose positions he has, is that, okay, let's take the terms upalakshana visheshana, and let's take them as possible in this context. Let us say, therefore, that Sri Man Narayana means that Sri and Narayana are in an upalakshana relationship. That in fact, in the situation in which we exist, maybe this eon of the universe, whatever, when we think of Narayana, we think of Sri with him, and we designate him as Supreme God because he is related to her. And that would be like the tree with the bird or the tree with the full moon. So yes, she is definitely part of the designation of the reference of liberation. But in fact, it's upalakshana. He could be perfectly Narayana if she was not there. And that could be true in both clauses of the Dvaya Mantra. I take refuge at the feet of Narayana with Sri, obeisance to Narayana with Sri. An alternate view, and this seems to be a compromised position, is that in the second clause, obeisance or praise to Narayana with Sri, let us assume there that it's a visheshana relationship. That in fact, whenever one praises Narayana, one also praises Sri. And let us say that Sri and Narayana are always praised together, Narayana would not want to be praised without Sri, and so on. So there we could concede that in fact they're always together as the designation and recipient of praise. But the opponent, the unnamed adversary, it's somewhere in the middle of that sheet, says, but in the first clause, clearly it cannot be the case that she is intrinsic to the act of liberation. So in the second clause, if you want visheshana, fine. We always praise them together. But in the first, it's upalakshana because Vishnu himself is the supreme, adequate, perfect, full means of liberation. And it would be a detriment. It would be implying his lack of perfection, his lack of the ability to save, his lack of compassion, and other such things, if one said that somehow he needed the help of this lady in the lotus. For the sake of the perfect theology of Narayana, we have to, in the first line, say that it is only upalakshana and not visheshana. To make it brief, and we can talk about this, in Vedanta Deshika's own teaching, he says, And then when I talk about the affect of the way he says it, he says clearly that is a wrong position. That if we are to take seriously who Sri Lakshmi is in our tradition, she is Visheshana in both the first and the second clause. So we praise them together, yes, but when we take refuge at the feet of Narayana, it is always and only with the goddess Sri. And therefore he says that the two of them together are the upaya, or the means to liberation. The two of them together are a refuge. And that any effort to think of her as secondary to him is simply unacceptable and intolerable. So that's his kind of solution. I think probably using that text of Ramanuja from the Sri Bhashya about Brahman by way of analogy, saying that this is the relationship of Narayana and Sri, Visheshana, not Upalakshana. And then he says it's like the qualities of the Lord. So omniscience, omnipotence, perfect compassion, determination to save, accessibility to those in need. Just as those qualities are eternally in the Lord, even though one cannot imagine, you know, that somehow the Lord depends on those qualities. So the Lord is not perfect because he depends on his compassion, or the Lord is not perfect because you have to say that he's omniscient. No, these are kind of intrinsic qualities to what we mean by Lord. Likewise, she is intrinsically part of what we mean by Narayana. So it's not as if somehow saying he can't do it on his own, he needs her help. But just as his truth, his omniscience, his perfection are entirely part of who he is, she is entirely part of who he is. The objective seems to say you're confusing two things. It's one thing to say omniscience, omnipotence, truth, compassion, etc. Those are gunas or qualities. And that surely can be thought of Narayana. But you can't have another person and say that somehow this person is an intrinsic part of that person. And Vedanta Deshika says, yes, you can, because I just said it. It seems to come down to that he says, this is the case. If you can have inanimate qualities like omniscience or perfection somehow part of the Lord without a detriment to him, why can't you have the lady and the lotus as part of him? And it's like they're shouting at each other, and he's kind of saying, I'll say this more forcefully than you say it, and you'll have to accept my view. The two things, and I'm almost finished, concluding comparative part, but two things striking about this section of 23, if you get that technical presentation, as I've tried to spell it out fairly simply. He goes on at great length in this section, both at the beginning of chapter 23 and then in this highly condensed section at the end, where he's at his most passionate, perhaps, in the entire text. He says the problem facing us is that people do not know how to reason properly. And again, he's not talking about Buddhists or Jains or Advaitins or Shaivites or others. He's like sitting here in this circle with the Acharyas, basically saying, the problem with you people is that you don't think properly, and therefore you don't understand what I'm saying to you. And I may be wrong in that, but I'm taking it as his kind of looking at his peers or looking at the most learned representatives of the tradition and saying, you people do not think properly. And the problem is why you don't agree with me is because you're swayed by all kinds of doubts. You're swayed by false thinking. I mean, he gives any number of terms in the text. Those who have kind of a pliable way of wisdom, Riddhu Prajna. Those who are Sarvidaya, who somehow have hearts in their thinking. Those who are Madhyastha Drishti, who have kind of a way of seeing things that's in the middle ground. You people are lacking that. You're not seeing properly. You're not seeing with balance. Those who are Drirda Purvashruto, and that seems to mean those who are attached to things they heard previously. They're kind of firm in the Purvashruta, and they're unable to get beyond things they were told before, almost as if saying, well, all right, you've grown up with this idea that she's only the Purushakara, that she's only the mediator. Get over it. I'm saying something to you more important than that. And the problem with you people is you know your tradition too well, and you're too in love with your tradition, and you can't let go of things that you held before. I think that would be a whole paper in itself. They're also your murka, your fools. So he goes on like this. You're also people who have questions who are embarrassed about asking your elders for answers. And now he doesn't say who he's talking to exact, but I'm taking it as if it's this inner circle. That the problem is you people, you've stopped thinking. You're too obsessed with your own tradition. You're unable to ask questions. You're acting foolishly. And again, he's not talking about kind of people out in the world who are running wild or whatever, but I think he's talking about the inner circle and their inability to understand his position. The other thing he says is basically, this is the, this sounds like something out of the Vatican, always and everywhere this has been the teaching of our tradition. And he just sort of says it to them. And he has long quotes from Yamuna, Olivandar, Ramanuja, Kura, Talvan, Parashara, Bhattar, these earlier very revered teachers, one called Periyajir, who's not clear who exactly that is, Somasi Undan, Nanjir, Kadambi Achan, these teachers, you know, before him and back to the earliest level of acharyas, saying, well, of course, they all agree with me. And if you people understood properly what your predecessors had been saying, then you would see that this is the obvious position. And there's a kind of a sleight of hand going on here, that he apparently is the first one to take Upalakshana Visheshana and apply it to the relationship of Sri Vishnu, and to make the analogy saying, just as omniscience is intrinsic to the Lord without any deficiency, so too she is intrinsic to the Lord without deficiency. And then he says, well, of course, this is what we've always taught. And you people, it's not that you're defending tradition against my novel idea, it's that I'm just explaining tradition to you, and you people don't understand the tradition. So I'd like then to move quickly to a few closing reflections on this, and then we can talk about the whole thing. One thing, of course, would be, and this would be another venue probably, to go back through the text and through all the detailed second handout there of the arguments. We can refer to that in the course of our discussion if you wish. But what to make of the Indological details and the kind of technical distinctions he's making, and other uses of word like Upalakshana Visheshana in the medieval Indian context and so on. You know, does this make sense even in the Indian context itself? Does it make sense in the Sri Vaishnava context? Other authors have obviously criticized him. Apparently soon after his time, there's a text written called the Rahasya Viveka by a Tengalai, or the other school of Vaishnavism, which lists a whole series of authorities saying these are the ones that show unanimously that Vedanta Deshika was wrong, often quoting some of the same people that Vedanta Deshika quoted. So we could go into some of that and sort of talk about, does this work? And then even on a general level, does it seem to be a coherent position to make this kind of analogy and say that the divine couple together can be the single means of liberation? Is that an intelligible position, and does he argue it? But that would be hard to do in this context without the text before us. But I'd like to close with a series of brief comparative reflections, and then we can talk about it. First of all, there are theological parallels, and I think by getting into, you know, the end of chapter 23 in this kind of detail, as I've tried to at least suggest to you, we're at a point of no longer simply having, you know, general comparisons or general thoughts about God and the different traditions, but the kind of technical theological distinctions and fine, refined points applied to the nature of the divine person or persons. And I think that opens up room for discussion. Had we time, we could talk about, for instance, to take up two vast topics in the briefest of time, we could talk about the divinity of Christ or the role of Mary in the Catholic tradition. Because I think much of the, and Professor Endian in the back of the room could do some of this better than I, but the early Christological controversies in the Catholic Church about who Jesus is and whether Jesus is, you know, the first of all created beings, or somehow somebody who can only be properly understood by seeing this person as divine, as the Father is divine. Can this be the firstborn of all creation and still have the status of being the means of salvation? And what I understand to be the consensus of the Church, that unless you say that Jesus is divine, the whole kind of Christological logic of Christianity will fall apart. So you have to kind of upgrade him to the role of a substantial, eternal person in the Trinity, otherwise it doesn't work. And that there's kind of an analogy there, that unless you have a high enough role for Jesus in the Christian tradition or Sri in the Vaishnava tradition, the whole thing doesn't really work and the mediator idea doesn't really follow. The ambiguities in the Catholic tradition about Mary, the role of Mary in relation to salvation, the common piety that many Catholics and I think Orthodox have about, you know, Mary's role as a mediator of grace, a mediator of salvation, can be left on the level of piety and iconic representations, and that's all fine, but can't God just do it alone? Do you really need Mary? And many Protestant churches say, you know, you don't need Mary in order to be saved, and she's not part of the salvific act. there's always this kind of push in the Catholic tradition, which is always resisted, about making Mary a co-redemptrix, that Mary is somehow an intrinsic co-partner in the act of human salvation. And the resistance of the Church, even in recent decades, about going that far, but kind of a certain tendency toward that. We could talk about that kind of thing. I was looking into the referent theologian that all Catholics get to eventually, Thomas Aquinas in the Summa Theologiae. There are passages in there, and I was looking around, and others again may have better ideas, but on the nature of the simplicity of God and the multiplicity of language, for one thing. In 113 in the Summa Theologiae, there are discussions about what the names of God mean, or what calling God good, wise, merciful, and so on mean. And isn't it the case, the adversary says, that these words actually are pious human constructions that ultimately tell us nothing about God, because God is pure and simple, and such words are not pure and simple. And Aquinas defending the idea that such names, in a sense, do tell us about the divine reality of God without introducing multiplicity into God. So that same kind of tension between talking about Narayana, the qualities of Narayana, the relation of Sri and Narayana, without somehow dividing God into parts and say there's the omniscient part, the Sri part, etc., seems to have this interesting parallel in Aquinas. Or in 131 in the Summa Theologiae on the unity and trinity of God. And is it really possible, and this is far too technical for me, probably for me, and certainly for me in this context to explain to you, but whether words like Trinity or the Son of the Father actually are meaningful if God is pure and simple, and whether such terms actually tell us something about the nature of the relationship of Father, Son, and Spirit to one another without destroying the unity of the one God. And Aquinas, like many major theologians, perhaps maybe all major mainstream Christian theologians, arguing that we can talk Trinitarian language and talk about the relationship of the members of the Trinity without any detriment to the unity of the divine reality. And there seems to be a similar kind of both anxiety and then urgency about being able to talk Father, Son, Spirit language and keep a kind of monotheistic simplicity that was criticized heavily in Islam and rejected as not actually working, that at least by analogy, this kind of sense of the one mediator of salvation or the one means of salvation, Narayana, talking about that as Sriman Narayana, introduces a kind of doubleness into the single pure reality that is in some ways like the Trinitarian reality in Aquinas. So I think those kinds of comparisons can be made, which I think is an important thing, because again, we can talk about comparative theology and some vague sense of interreligious dialogue, but when you get into the technical details of theological reflection, then it's not so much can you have a Christian thinker and a Hindu thinker next to each other, but they're dealing with similar problems about the unity, simplicity of God and the multiplicity of language, or some tradition of persons in God in relation to the unity and simplicity of God. They're both dealing with a similar theological problem, and they should be able to learn from one another about how to do this. But my final thoughts would be, three perhaps. One would be, and they're a little bit of out of order from the handout, but is this theology of Sri that Deshik is pushing relevant, let's say, for feminist theology? And when I originally took up this topic, I thought, oh, this will be fine, and this will show that we have Vedanta Deshika, medieval a feminist theologian, remarkably so. But in some ways, I think the arguments could be used in that direction about the equality of the female figure to the male and not subordinate in any way. But on the other hand, there's very little, oddly, about gender in the discussion of Sri and Narayana in their relationship to one another. There's very little in terms of the technical details of the argument that advert to the fact that it's a she and a he. And the adversaries in chapter 23 don't say, well, no woman can be part of the divine Godhead or something like that, or women couldn't possibly be means of salvation. There's none of that. It's more about the problem of the two and the one. And so I think in some ways, although it's talking about a god and a goddess, less than I may have hoped for at the beginning of this project, there's less there for kind of feminist theological reflection in any narrow sense where gender is the issue. It might be helpful, but I think it's not a very strong direction to move. But the other thing I'd like to say, the 2 points about reasoning and tradition, which to some extent raise a legitimate concern, and I'll close with this. On the one hand, when Vedanta Deshik is making this argument, as I pointed out, it's very technical and so on, but he basically turns to his opponents and says, the problem with you people is you don't think properly. And obviously he's not arguing any kind of simple logic or simple, you know, cause and effect, but he's arguing a very kind of nuanced, subtle sense that if you think properly and you're, you know, mature and disciplined and ascetic and devotional and all of these things together, you will come to the conclusion that I've offered to you. And this seems to be, you know, it can be a vicious circle that, and this happens, I think, in other forms of theology, but not only theology. You know, the problem with you is that you're not thinking correctly, that is to say you don't agree with me. And on one level, as I've done in other of my writings, I like to say that reason is kind of a bridge between traditions. But when it comes down to this kind of subtle point where, you know, the acharya says to the other acharyas, we're trying to discuss this reasonably and you people are not being reasonable because you're not making the logical connections, and I'm saying to you that just as qualities are a part of the reality of God, Shri is a part of the reality of God, this is a logical, reasonable thing to say, and you people think it's not reasonable. Which would lead me to the worry about then when we're trying to talk across religious boundaries, saying this is reasonable, that's reasonable, we actually have much more engaged and we have many more things at stake than simply any kind of narrow or simple logic. And that often we have great investment in reason, that is to say reasoning as I reason, and not as your reasoning. And then it becomes almost like an argument where it has no resolution, that you end up shouting at each other, you end up missing each other because we're all thinking reasonably, but unfortunately we're not coming to the same conclusion. And then the other thing, finally, the appeal to tradition. So he quotes the different acharyas and says, well, all the acharyas agree with me. And the two problems with that is, one I already mentioned, shortly after this text, apparently, this other text, Rahasya Viveka, was written, in which the other acharya says, no, you're actually wrong, all these acharyas agree with us, not with you. So, you know, quoting authority can be a messy thing, and you can be quoting traditional figures one way or the other. And then if you go back and read them, those that are available in writing, they're ambiguous, and then you end up making judgments about, you know, what did Pariyavachan Pillai actually mean? What did Yamana actually mean? You know, what did Aquinas mean? What did Augustine mean? Whose side are they on in our argument? These are long arguments in theological traditions. So that becomes very unwieldy in the sense that theologians often do this, I think. I have tradition on my side and you don't. Can be very forceful because both Sri Vaishnavas and Christians often take tradition extremely seriously, you know, tradition with a capital T, the Sampradaya or whatever. But in some ways it comes down to something really undecidable in the sense that, it's my reading of tradition versus your reading of tradition, and how do you use these figures in relationship to one another? And then outside of the context, if we're trying to argue or think across religious boundaries, and if Vedanta Deshika is saying, well, it's really essential to know what Alavandar said and Ramanuja said and Kuratalavan said and so on, that could be absolutely nothing to a thinker who's a Muslim or a Christian. Like, you know, those potent figures of your tradition say nothing to me. There is no kind of impact of authority there. And while you're quoting tradition, it's your tradition, and I'm not in your tradition, so you can't quote tradition to me. But getting away from tradition seems to rob traditions of a lot of their power. And the same thing of, you know, if you read papal documents, they're always quoting predecessors and quoting great theologians. And if a Hindu or a Muslim or a Jew would say, you're quoting all things that we don't care about, why should we pay attention to those? On one level, it's perfectly fair. And on another level, it seems that you don't really get what Catholic doctrine is about unless you take tradition seriously. You don't get what Sri Vaishnava doctrine is about unless you take tradition seriously. But how can we be in a context where somebody of one tradition begins to take the teachers of the other tradition seriously? Is that possible? And it seems to some extent that this, you know, nuanced view of what reasoning is, nuanced view of tradition, are essential for a kind of an interreligious understanding of something like the reality of Sri or the divinity of Christ. And therefore, you know, it's not a logical matter of proving, disproving, but you need people sort of bonded across religious boundaries to the extent that they can begin to think together and their traditions are intermingled with one another before something substantive can be said about Sri that would be recognizable to a Christian. And that opens up, obviously, a very large, you know, set of future tasks. So I think with that, I will stop and welcome any questions, discussion you have. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to invite questions or remarks.
So when Vedanta Deshika talks about ontology of Sri, how does he describe, like, does he use like expression like guna guni, avyaya?
I don't think he uses guna guni, or I don't think he uses either of those terms. As I mentioned, you know, he gives a functional description of who she is in chapter 28, the Shriyate, etc., those different six meanings of Sri. But he seems to be making you know, something like gunavat, just as the qualities like omniscience, omnipotence, are part of Narayana without being a detriment, as if you could imagine them not being there. She is just like that. And this person has this analogous status that just as these qualities would have. And that, he says, this is perfectly reasonable. If you can imagine that God can have qualities, why couldn't God have a consort? And that, you can see that being arguable, at least, if not dubious.
I think somewhere Ramanuja makes a distinction between God in essence, his svarupa, and his power, his vibhuti. Does Vedanta Deshika relate his doctrine of Sri into that kind of...
No. I think in certain texts, not in chapter 23, he will talk about that in all of the five forms of Narayana, you know, the para form and the vibhuti form, vibhava form, and so on. She's always present in all these forms. But as far as I know, at least in what I've read, there's no kind of swarupa, swabhava, or swarupa, vibhuti form, such as she would be one and not the other. He seems to be heading to the position that whatever you would talk about Narayana, she would be intrinsically part of that. And he doesn't want to leave any kind of room for distinction or difference. Except, like echoing earlier teachers, like Parashara Bhattar and Sri Guna Ratnakosha, that they may then, in their perfect equality, choose to have different roles. But in this chapter, he doesn't discuss that. I have thoughts on either the specific thing or the comparative thing. I'm curious what you think. Yes?
I was curious about, is Sri often described as Shakti in the Chandradishika's description as Shakti, like often we make the distinction between Shakti and Shaktiman, as the power is inseparable from the powerful, or fire set, smoke is inseparable from fire.
I think the analogy is used in some of the texts he quotes between like the fire and its light, the fire and its heat. I think that there may be a way in which the Sri Vaishnava tradition is avoiding the Shakti term. Probably you can open and find it right on some page where he uses Shakti, but and there's a long list of like the attributes of Narayana and Sri in the Rahasya Trayasara. But I think like in chapter 23, I'm pretty sure that does not appear, and that he does not draw on this analogy of Shakti, Shaktiman. And he seems to be wanting to get at something, what he thinks is more essential and basic, that both of them are entirely the means of salvation, the cause of salvation, the recipient of salvation, and that any effort to kind of have him as the possessor of her, even though the mutt would imply that, he seems to be avoiding that.
Jim? I had a question about the Purushakara, and I was just curious. I know so little about any of this, but in the earlier tradition where she is recognized as Purushakara, what kind of attributes or consequences would there be, especially with the use of that term?
He explains, and some of the commentators take up, how did she get to be a Purushakara, which is some kind of a role of the one who makes the Purusha accessible, or as some kind of a you know, intermediary who brings you to the Purusha. Why does she get to be the Purushakara? They seem to be worried about the gender thing and how she's a Purushakara, because they think it's usually some kind of a intermediary male figure. But you're asking about rather the function or the behavior?
Well, if she, for Vedanta Deshikesh, in some way promoted, upgraded from Purushottara to Abhisheshana or something like that, I just wondered what kind of descriptive paraphernalia she would have had as Purushottara. I mean, it's just, I don't know the use of that term particularly.
I mean, the classic place of it is in Vedanta Deshika's predecessor, Pillai Lokacharya, was one of the great preceding teachers who then becomes the key teacher of the other school, the Tengalai school. And he talks about her her affection, her accessibility, her compassion, you know, that, and you see this in some of the older poetry, that Narayana stands for justice, she stands for mercy, and just like your father treats you one way and your mother treats you another way. And then they'll tell stories like in the Ramayana, where the crow Kaka is pecking at the chest of Sri Sita while Ramayana is resting, and then Rama gets angry and attempts to kill the crow, and then Sita advises the crow, take refuge at his feet and he won't kill you, as an example of the kind of role that she will play in giving people good advice and telling them not to be afraid and telling them to go to him. So those kinds of stories are told, but a lot of it is just maternal imagery about she's like your mother, and you can always go to her when you're in trouble. And partly, I guess I could add that even in chapter 28, when he uses the term, it seems to be a sense that this is, we have a consensus on this, and we don't need to explain it very much. And that what I haven't done, and I don't have it available here, the Sri Vachana Bhushanam of Pillai Lokacharya begins with the distinction, he is the Upaya, she is the Purushakara. And then Manavala Mamunigal in his commentary explains more about each term and some of those characterizations and quotes that go with that. And Deshika seems to be saying, well, we know that she is the Purushakara in chapter 28. Let us take that for granted, so there's nothing to debate here. And he doesn't like fill it out with images and so on. And in chapter 28 even, he's more worried about what the with means.
Yeah.
The Sri with Narayana or Narayana with Sri. But the term is not problematized. And then, for some reason, I mentioned chapter 23, there's no mention of Purushakara at all. It's like that is, for him, either some other issue or it's no longer... He never says she's not the Purushakara, mm-hmm. but he doesn't want to talk about that when he's really grabbing onto the issue. Yes?
I had a question. Is this term Purushakara, if it is a technical term of the Sri Vaishnava tradition, I'm not very sure. Otherwise... The word Purushakara is literally translated as the effort of human beings. So is it somewhere denoting such types of meaning? Purusha Bhagya is one way and Purushakara is on the other way.
I recall looking in some of the commentaries on Rahasya Trayasaram and also a while ago now on the Sri Vachana Bhushanam, and the commentary is trying to explain what this word means.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't seem to take it in any way as meaning some kind of the effort of the Purusha.
No.
They seem to take it as some kind of a legal term, some kind of a like juridical term almost, of the advocate in the courtroom or something. And I recall one of the, I don't have the notes here, but the one who makes accessible the Purusha to you.
Okay.
So it's some kind of an odd etymology.
Maybe then it's a technical term.
Yeah.
Then the second question is regarding the Srimat Narayana. Is there any argument that Sri is preceding Nar? Everywhere, Srimat. So Matu Pratyaya, according to Sanskrit grammar, has different connotations that I'm not going into. But my worry or query here is limited to the preceding position of Sri. Does anywhere this argument reflect in his work? Or the one place where you say that the ontological questions he's taking there, he is talking only of Narayana and not of Sri. But is there he using the term Sriman Narayana or simply Narayana?
I don't think it's discussed in the text. I mean, if I understand you properly, it's taken as auspicious that the word Sri comes first in both lines of the mantra.
Mm-hmm.
Sri Mad Narayana, Sri Mate Narayanaya.
Yeah.
And that this is auspicious, just as Srimad Rahasya Trayasara, Sri, in many contexts, Sri comes first. I don't think I've not seen in Deshika at least, any kind of argument that shows some kind of priority on her. You would think that argument might be made.
Yeah.
But I don't know,
That couldn't possibly mean that he is somehow dependent on her.
No, but she's inseparably related. That is what. And she has a special position.
Yeah.
If everywhere she's preceding the title of him.
Yeah.
So maybe.
I think in some other texts, like in Parashara Bhatra's Sri Gunaratha Kosha, that point comes up.
Yeah.
And I think the very debate they have about the meaning of the matta there has to do with whether there is separability or not. And they all seem to be saying, well, in fact, they're together. But the view he seems to be fighting against is that this implies that they could be separate. So
yeah,
you know,
that depends on what concept they take of the guna and the guni. If they think that both of them are separable, then they may.
And that's precisely the argument he's making in chapter 23, that his opponents seem to be saying that he could be the complete divine reality by himself, whereas he is saying that would be as inconceivable as saying God without God's omniscience or God without God's mercy. You can't imagine them separately, even though you use two words, Sri and Narayana.
Yeah.
That's just like using Narayana and omniscience, whatever, something like that.
Yeah. I had a question about comparative theology. You've made a case that Vedanta Deshika is dealing with a similar issue as Aquinas or other Catholic theologians with regard to relationship of the goddess and God. And obviously Aquinas and Vedanta Deshika never talked. They probably didn't read each other.
As far as we know.
But my question is, once you've steeped yourself in both these traditions, so once you get immersed within the theological concepts and you see these similarities in the parallels, in what sense does it make sense to talk about two entirely distinct traditions? Obviously, again, they're historically isolated and linguistically isolated, but in what sense, for one who is immersed in them, is there, in what sense do you look at them as entirely distinct? Have they somehow transcended themselves and touched upon issues which are similar in the same way that two mathematicians who may have lived entirely different areas and entirely different.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I always kind of rush through it and mutter under my breath, of course, there are differences, and then leave that behind. But, you know, you can point to innumerable historical differences in the development of Christological documents or this theology of Sri. And you could talk about the, you know, the nature of the technical language that's developed is different, et cetera, et cetera. And traditional believers in both traditions might take great offense at the fact of making the analogy that, you know, discussions of the divinity of Christ in the Christian tradition is not at all like the heathen discussion of the heathens in India, or some analogous other version of that, this is sacred and true and that is false, something like that. I mean, you could see that kind of thing. But I think both traditions theologically argue that, you know, out of reflection, out of exegesis, out of discussion comes some substantive truth, and that it's not all contextual and it's not all an endless construction of local realities, but that, you know, both Aquinas and Deshika, it is true that this person has this divine equal status. And they're both claiming that there is a kind of universal truth at stake. And I'm arguing, you know, both that we have to take seriously, if we take seriously the claims that they're making in their traditions of truth, then we would expect it to be some way in which these truths or claims about truth could at least be brought together for reflection. Because neither is claiming, I'm just doing this for South Indians or I'm just doing this for medieval Europeans. But we're doing this because it's true and it's about God. And then also it seems on the, you know, the more technical level, that if, as I was trying to just hint at with the references to Aquinas, they're struggling with similar theological problems about how to use human language about divine reality. And that both traditions, despite the differences of Latin and Sanskrit, etc., have some kind of a conception that, on the one hand, we all know that human language cannot measure up to this discussion, and the plurality of things we say in our language are not easily transferable into the divine. Nonetheless, they're both arguing, as Ramanuja did before Deshika, that we can say meaning, we can make meaningful claims that we understand and that tell us something substantive about God. But all of that, again, can get lost if, in my final two points, that people say, Well, that would depend on the fact that you think we reason the same way in both traditions. And the real pundits in both traditions say that people who reason like me are correct and people who reason like you are not correct. Or the problem, you know, the lack of tradition, and tradition is so much a part of it. But I'd like to say that even with the reasoning and tradition, you can begin to cultivate ways of reasoning that are adequate in both traditions, are recognizable in both traditions, and you can learn tradition across the boundaries. But the main thing is that these are judgments and claims about the truth of reality, that even without historical connection, there should be some kind of a convergence. Unless you posit, you know, one is false and the other is true, but anyone posit that. Yes?
Just as a layperson's level, if you go to Tirupati, it is Srinivasa there, where the Sri is there. You go to a temple in Batarangam, the Lakshmi, the Sri, is not even within the same mandapam. She's completely separate. So this belief was still practiced at the practical level as well. You go to Srirangam, the Sri will be within the same mandapam. And Batarangam, which is supposed to be aligned very similar to Srirangam, but the difference being the Lakshmi is separate.
Yeah.
And the Ranganatha is worshipped in his entirety there, with no Sri there at all.
Yeah.
I mean, what I'm trying to bring out is that these two schools happen to be there even in practice.
This comes up at the bottom of that outline, number 51 toward the bottom of the page.
Mm-hmm.
A final objection from religious practice. Why does Sri have shrines separate from his if he and she are in, as if she and he are separable? And he refers to the Laya, Boga, and Adhikara forms. So it seems precisely your point is already an issue in their time, that the Laya form, the commentators say, means when it is Srivas, that she's on his chest and is kind of intrinsic within his reality in some shrines. And others are the Boga form when they're like next standing next to one another, together in their mutual enjoyment. And then the Adhikara form they take to mean when there is a separate shrine for Sri separate from Vishnu. As at Srirangam, actually, the Tayar Sannidhi is outside. I've never been able to go into either of them, but the Tayar Sannidhi is, you know, you have to go around and out to get to her shrine, and his is separate. And Deshika's answer is, well, these are three different modes of imagining their relationship for the sake of different needs of devotees. So you have the Laya form, the Boga form, in terms of two ways of imagining their intimate relationship. The Adhikara form seems that some people just like to pray to her for certain things, and they just want to talk to her, so they're allowed to go there. But he argues, and this is debatable, that you can't argue from temple structure or architecture and murtis. You can't argue from that to theology, which actually seems that you could, and say, well, in fact, the practice of the tradition is that they can be approached separately, so they are separable. So he tries to take into account your point, but I think it's a good point to raise that the theology is one thing, and the actual pious practice of the tradition may make it seem architecturally even that it's more complicated than he's leading on. But he takes up your point and says, no, it doesn't mean at all that they could be imagined separately. No, good point, thank you.
Okay. Just the point of convergence between different religious traditions, I was thinking, what exactly your picture of different traditions, for example, in this case, Christian tradition and Hindu tradition, learning from each other, are you suggesting that maybe it's possible, like, the Christian theologian can engage in the act of constructing Christian theology, but adopting the Hindu terminologies like upanakshana or appreciation or these things, or the other way around. I mean, I suppose Hindus can adopt Christian concepts in constructing their own theology. Are you thinking of something?
Well, I think a good question, and good for a last question, if it's the last question. I mean, that on this could be taken on two levels, one easier and one harder. But on the easier level, though it's not simple easy, is that the technical, it seems possible that the technical distinctions of one tradition can be of use in another tradition, and that while Aquinas' technical Latin is unknown to Sri Vaishnavas by, you know, historically, and Upalakshana Visheshana was not known to medieval Europeans, there seems to be no good reason why these terminology and distinctions couldn't be used across traditional boundaries.
And I would think even, you know, the most traditional or conservative of theologians would have a hard time arguing against that. That if, you know, in the Christian tradition, if biblical thought could be interpreted in terms of Greek philosophical terminology, and if Aquinas could use Aristotelian terminology and borrow things from Maimonides and the Arab thinkers, well, why not use the technical terms of traditions in relation to one another? But further and more substantively, if we, as both traditions believe in this case, theology, you know, sort of comes from faith and worship and leads to faith and worship, and both Aquinas and the early Christians and Vaishika are concerned about maintaining the piety of their tradition through good theology, it would also mean that good theology, even if borrowed from another tradition, could lead to a change in faith and a change in piety. And it seems to me on the surface very hard to imagine saying that a Christian therefore could develop piety for Lakshmi, or somehow imagine that the Trinitarian understanding of God a Christian has could just as well be imagined as Narayana with Sri. It seems also hard to say, well, why not? That the logic of this theological exchange could lead to changes in piety, changes in faith down the road. But then it's where tradition kicks back in and says, well, no, because we simply don't do that. And if you think we do that, it's because you're not thinking properly. And the other arguments kick in, like where Deshika starts stamping his foot and saying, you people, you know, you're thinking like a pagan or something like that. Because they're afraid of where this might lead. And I think a theologian today might say, well, sure, it could lead to that, but not, we don't want it to, so therefore it doesn't. So is that ambiguous enough? Thank you.
I see it as a kind of contemporary Vedanta Deshika telling your peers to think straight. So,
that's right.
Yes. Thanks so much for an extremely stimulating lecture and very thought provoking.
Thank you.
Giving colleagues shape on lectures.